العالمين أضفع له نور أليق والظالم ابتده من أجل السالكين أهدى سنه مهدينا في الأزمان شع ضيه ربنا في العالمين أضفع له نور أليق والظالم ابتده من أجل السالكين أهدى سنه
Brother Alevian, so about the deviations you're talking about, beautiful about the deviations. Now the question is that are these deviations unrelated to the concept of religion or no? For example, a chemist, a physicist, a mathematician, a scientist in different fields of studies are deviated from their right path of life, you know? Everybody has been given a duty or responsibility according to his expertise. Are the companions of the imams and the imam himself are going to reform or correct them too or not?
Very true. Look, if you paid attention to what I explained, definitely you have been accompanying me. But yes. I want to say that when I mentioned one of the factors of these deviations are owners of power.
Okay.
They are that actually the capitalist system,
yes.
that they are the creator of this. I mean, in order to live, in order to survive, they need to change the philosophy of life.
Yes.
Right? So when these leaders, when these actually companions, special companions of Imam are going to come and to do reformations,
yes.
so they actually, one of their targets are these kinds of actually people. So we see that they work on those areas that they are the owners of power. They are the owners of wealth. So, but they, in order to keep this power, keep this wealth, they are trying to deceive others and to ignore the rights of others, to violate the rights of others.
Yes.
But when people are enlightened, then they find this enlightenment,
yes.
so they are up to accept. And it's interesting that Imam Ali Salam says, Imam Sadr Ali Salam says that these people that are going to enlighten people, they are not ordinary people. They are high judges, they are big chiefs, they are jurists in religious law, they are scholars of religion,
yes.
and they have just been blessed with divine inspiration.
Inspiration, that's yeah. This is important.
And so, and it is, they work in a way that, I mean, that no mistake can be taken from them.
Oh.
So it doesn't mean that they are infallible, but they are, I mean, close to the borders of infallibility.
As you said, they have been accompanying an imam like Ammar,
yeah.
or like Malik al-Ashtar, or like the companions of Imam al-Hussein.
Very true.
You know, they could find a way into the very enlightening soul of the imam, okay?
Mm.
So now they found the way, so based upon the blessings and the rahmah of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, and imam asked, they are ready to answer different types of questions, stop the people from deviations. That's right. Thank you very much, Brother Alevian.
You're welcome.
What is the next mission of the Sahabi of Imam As? Inshallah, you explain it to us in our upcoming session of the program, The Last
Interview.
Thank you very much,
You're
Brother
welcome.
Alevian, for this episode. And thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to the program, The Last Savior. Till another episode, God bless you all. Fi amanallah.
Where is the rising sun? Where is the spring of life? Where is the shining moon? Where is the firmest glow? Please, oh please, please come. Please, oh, oh, oh. Please come. Please come.
Midstream.
Palestinian resistance Hamas responded on Friday, March 15, to the Paris 2 proposal with a phased agreement that emphasized the cessation of aggression on the Gaza Strip with withdrawal of the Israeli occupation army and the commencement of relief operations. However, the Israeli entity authorities are focusing on the issue of their captives to circumvent ending the aggression file. In the details, Hamas's proposed document includes a temporary ceasefire lasting 42 days in the first stage and transitioning to a permanent ceasefire in the second stage. In the first stage, the Palestinian resistance Hamas demands the withdrawal of Israeli forces from specific areas and offers to release of Palestinian prisoners in exchange for Israeli entity captive soldiers. The second stage requires a permanent ceasefire before any further prisoner exchanges. The proposal also involves launching a comprehensive reconstruction process for Gaza and ending the blockade. Hamas spokesperson Osama Hamdan affirmed in a press conference that the occupation is trying to shift the focus to the issue of captives to circumvent ending this aggression, considering the paper presented by the movement as realistic and highly flexible. Hamdan emphasized the prisoner exchange must take place, but not at the expense of fundamental issues, foremost of which is stopping the aggression. In contrast, the office of the Israeli entity Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu described Hamas's proposal as unrealistic, but announced that a delegation would head to Qatar to discuss a potential agreement. In the same statement, Netanyahu's office added that the latter approved plans for the military operation in the city of Rafah, noting that the army is preparing for operational matters and for the evacuation of civilian populations. As for the Americans, they quickly seized upon Hamas's response, coming out to express their optimism, albeit cautiously. However, what stood out in their remarks is that they considered Hamas's proposal to be definitely within the framework of the deal we have been working on in recent months. This is according to a statement made by the National Security Council coordinator at the White House, John Kirby, on Friday, March 15. Kirby expressed hope that ceasefire talks in Gaza are moving in the right direction, adding, "We are closely involved in negotiations in Doha and believe that progress can be made. There is a new round involving other parties." At a time when Israeli entity reservations were clearly evident regarding the resistance imposing conditions concerning Palestinian prisoners to be released. On the other hand, what Cairo directly conveyed to its panelists is that the success of this deal will be linked to the seriousness of the parties in implementing it, and that what will be agreed upon in Doha must be binding, and it is not logical for there to be a resumption of fighting. Welcome to the Middle East Stream. I'm Mara Osman. As the Israeli entity War Cabinet and the Ministerial Committee for Security Affairs were briefed on Friday on the Palestinian resistance Hamas's response regarding the anticipated ceasefire and the prisoner exchange deal between the two sides, new details have emerged after lengthy negotiations mediated by Egypt, Qatar, and the United States of America. To discuss this issue with us from Beirut is Mr. Mohammed Al-Haj Musa, spokesperson of the Islamic Jihad Palestinian Resistance. Thank you very much for being with us, Mr. Mohammed. Now, Hamas responded on Friday, March 15, to the Paris 2 proposal with an agreement that prioritizes ending the genocidal war on the Gaza Strip, withdrawing of the Israeli occupation forces, and initiating relief efforts. However, the Israeli entity authorities are focusing on the issue of their own settler captives, especially the soldier ones, to avoid addressing the complete cessation of aggression on the Palestinian Gaza Strip. How do you see the talks moving on from this point?
Peace be upon you all. Greetings to you and to our brave, steadfast people under the Zionist killing machine. We affirm that this Zionist entity, which has not achieved any goals on the ground due to the steadfastness of the resistance, the resilience of the Palestinian people, and the steadfastness of the resistance men in various support arenas, is now embarrassed and knows that the end of the war means its inevitable loss in the battle. Any war and any battle are determined by achieving political objectives, not by the ability to destroy, wreak havoc, kill, and commit genocide as the criminal occupation does. This occupation believes that ending the war under the current reality with the presence and steadfastness of the resistance is a crushing defeat for it, as it does not want to end the war but wants to emerge victorious. Therefore, by continuing this war, it tries to achieve any of its military objectives and wants to release its prisoners unconditionally and complete its aggression. Naturally, as resistance, we will not allow that. Our Palestinian people have made many sacrifices, and we are steadfast in the field until the occupation is forced to agree to our conditions in recognition of our sacrifices and the sacrifices of our people. All the conditions we, as resistance, have set, we have shown very high flexibility with the mediators and dealt positively with the principle of lifting this injustice from our people, not because we are weak. On the contrary, thank God we are present in every confrontation arena in every inch of Gaza, and we will continue until this occupation knows that it must agree to our conditions. Part of the pressure exerted by the occupation is media pressure, and we have shown high flexibility for negotiations and that we are ready to discuss this issue.
Well, Mr. Mohammed, the office of the Israeli entity Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu labeled the proposal coming from the Palestinian resistance as an unrealistic proposal. They didn't like it, but they declared that they will send a team to the Qatari capital, Doha, to explore the possibility of an accord. The Netanyahu administration but then said that it has approved a plan to actually invade Rafah. Do you think this is part of the negotiation bluffing tactic by the Zionist team, or will Zionist Israel actually outdo itself in its own genocidal warfare and genocidal behavior and try and actually attempt to invade Rafah, which is packed right now with 2 million displaced Palestinians?
Exactly what you said. This is part of the continuous Zionist lies and deception since the beginning of this aggression. And before that, throughout this aggression, they lie and try to mislead public opinion. It is very clear that there is a contradiction in the occupation because it realizes that it is now forced to provide answers after its failure in the field since the beginning of the war until today, and after the images of massacres and genocide that come out of a strip over time. The world today no longer hears and sees with Israeli entity and American eyes. The world now realizes the facts, thanks to the steadfastness of the Palestinian people and what Palestinians show over time in images that confirm the massacres of this occupation. Therefore, some governments demand that the Zionists to reduce the state of killing because they have achieved nothing yet. Now the occupation constantly threatens to go to Rafah and commit massacres while saying that it is also continuing the political process at the same time. How is that possible? This threat comes within the framework of the same negotiations. It threatens to have bargaining chips, thinking that by doing so it can pressure us in the resistance and push us to retreat and submit to its conditions. The fundamental dilemma here is that it blackmails us into postponing the military operation in Rafah, not stopping the aggression. Therefore, this is something we will not allow in the resistance. In our opinion, agreeing to any of these issues means leaving our people to this occupation to continue its killing and achieve its dream of displacement. So if the resistance agrees to any conditions without the basic points, this means accepting a siege harsher than it has been for 17 years. And this means that we are facing a more difficult reality as Palestinians. We are in a stage that requires steadfastness and resilience. What is happening in the Strip is painful and very difficult humanely, but we as resistance remain steadfast in the field. All our military units are still operating in the field, and we will not allow the occupation and the Americans to snatch from our hands the paper of the prisoners' release, only for them to return to killing and extermination.
Mr. Mohammed, this is what I want to talk to you about with the last 2 minutes that we have. The comments that we heard from John Kirby, who is the White House coordinator for the National Security Council, said that the proposal by the resistance in Palestine actually falls within the framework that the U.S. is trying to portray to end the aggression on Gaza. I find personally that a bit hard to believe, since the U.S. has been evidently found to be complicit in the genocide against our Palestinian brothers and sisters. So why are they suddenly so optimistic now?
In my opinion, the United States is not optimistic because when it announced that what Hamas and the Palestinian resistance presented comes within the framework of the Paris paper negotiations, they want by this statement to pressure Netanyahu as part of the soft pressure between Biden and Netanyahu due to their difference in tactics. They are certainly in agreement at the strategic level, but at the tactical level, the U.S. administration has emphasized that Netanyahu is currently stuck in the Gaza quagmire, and that continuing the war as it is means that this entity will be in real danger in the coming days due to the steadfastness of the Palestinian people, the resistance, and the efforts of both brothers in all support arenas until the conditions of resistance are achieved. What the United States wants is a tactical change in the war. As for Netanyahu, he is exploring new objectives to prolong this war. But Biden realizes through all the reports from the Zionist field, like Eisenkot, Gantz, and others, that the occupation army cannot achieve Netanyahu's illusions. This has caused some problems at the tactical level. In our opinion, the U.S. administration is not a partner in this war, but rather is managing this war since Biden came and chaired the Zionist War Council. But it seems that Netanyahu has gone beyond the boundaries drawn for him and aspires to achieve more objectives. However, the United States knows that the resistance in Gaza remains alive, present, accepted, and supported by the Palestinian people. Biden wants this extermination, but he supports it with a soft extermination, without sound and image, and stopping it would end the state of global discontent that has reached the streets of the West.
Thank you very much, Mr. Mohammed Al-Haj Musa, spokesperson of the Islamic Jihad Palestinian Resistance, for your time and effort to be on our show to discuss what the proposal of the resistance is and what to expect from the upcoming talks in Qatar. Now, ladies and gents, please stay tuned because next we are going to talk about a very rare meeting that took place between Palestinian resistance factions and the Yemeni Ansarullah resistance.
This is Midstream, and here is IRIB English Radio. Dear listeners, in this weekly program, Marwa Osman discusses two important issues related to West Asia region with two political analysts. Midstream is with you every Friday on IRIB English Radio.
Informed sources revealed a meeting that brought together multiple Palestinian factions from Hamas, the Islamic Jihad, and the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine with the Ansarullah resistance movement in Yemen during the past few days to coordinate regarding the upcoming phase. The sources, as per Agence France-Presse, stated that the purpose of the meeting was to coordinate positions with Ansarullah, who in turn confirmed their continued support operations in the Red Sea and beyond in support of Palestinians facing genocide by Zionist Israel. More details in the following report.
A rare meeting was held last week between leaders of Palestinian resistance factions and the Yemeni Ansarullah resistance group to discuss mechanisms for coordinating the resistance's actions against Zionist Israel, according to Palestinian sources cited by Agence France-Presse, AFP. The agency did not mention the names of these sources it spoke to on Friday evening, but attributed one of them, who refused to be named, as saying, "An important meeting was held last week with senior leaders from Hamas, Islamic Jihad, and the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, along with the Ansarullah resistance movement, to discuss coordination mechanisms between these factions regarding resistance actions in the upcoming stage." According to a second source, also unnamed, the Ansarullah movement confirmed during the meeting that it will continue its operations in the Red Sea against ships heading to the enemy state, meaning Zionist Israel, to support Palestinian resistance. The meeting also discussed the complementarity of the Yemeni role with Palestinian factions, especially with the possibility of Zionist Israel invading Rafah. The agency did not specify the location of the meeting, the names of the participants from the Palestinian faction's leadership, or the Ansarullah movement. This revelation comes after the leader of the Ansarullah resistance movement, Sayyid Abdul Malik al-Houthi, announced expanding the scope of attacks on ships linked to Zionist Israel, including those avoiding passage through the Red Sea and sailing in the Indian Ocean via the Cape of Good Hope in the far south of the African continent. Since November 19 last year, Yemen's armed forces, which are aligned with Ansarullah, have targeted Israeli entity-linked ships in the Red Sea and the Arab Sea in solidarity with the people of Palestine, who are currently facing genocide in the Gaza Strip. The US and UK have been waging a violent aerial campaign against Yemen since mid-January in response to Yemeni naval operations. Since this campaign began, the scope of Yemen's operations has expanded to include US and British vessels. As a result of Yemeni operations, major international shipping companies have been forced to reroute their vessels around South Africa's Cape of Good Hope, where Ansarullah vowed to prevent ships from reaching as part of the new expanded operations.
Now to discuss this issue with us from Beirut is Mr. Ali Al-Zahri, Yemeni journalist and political commentator. Thank you very much for being with us, Mr. Ali. Now, in a very rare meeting, at least since the Al-Aqsa flood operation that happened on October 7, 2023, the Palestinian resistance factions have met secretly with the Yemeni resistance movement Ansarullah. Now, it was not revealed where this meeting took place or with whom and at what level this meeting took place. But what does that meeting signify at this point in time of the genocidal U.S. Zionist war on Gaza?
In the name of Allah, the Most Gracious, the Most Merciful, greetings to you and to all the valiant fighters in Palestine, Lebanon, Iraq, Syria, Yemen, and all the free people in this world. Regarding the meeting, it came as a culmination of the coordination and communication efforts since the early days of the Al-Aqsa flood operations, which is a natural outcome dictated by circumstances, data, and the magnitude of the great battle. This meeting is not the first of its kind, as stated by the leader of the revolution, Sayyid Abdul Malik al-Houthi, that coordination and communication with all resistance movements are ongoing. Each resistance movement has offices in Sana'a, and communication has been ongoing before and after the flood. However, the announcement of this meeting was made without much information about it, as a culmination of this integration in various arenas, and due to the significant developments on the ground, it was necessary to elevate the process of communication and also intensify the strikes to support Palestinian resistance on the negotiation table. There are media reports that the meeting was held in the Lebanese capital, Beirut, which is natural because the battle is won and Yemen must be a supporting front in it. We affirm that the Yemeni Republic coordinates greatly regarding the military aspect in addition to military support. It leaves a negotiation matter, as Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah stated, that the Palestinian negotiator today negotiates on behalf of all resistance movements. We are supportive fronts and leave the negotiation entirely to the Palestinian negotiator. Even the issue of holding the Israeli ship and its crew is solely in the hands of our people in the Al-Qassam Brigades. If they want to keep the crew or exchange them, there is no objection. It's up to them.
Well, Mr. Ali, the leader of the Yemeni Ansarullah movement, Sayyid Abdul Malik Badruddin Houthi, announced in his speech on March 14th that his group will expand its maritime operations in support of the resistance in Gaza against the Israeli entity-linked shipping, not only preventing them from passing through the Arabian Sea or the Red Sea or the Aden, the Gulf of Aden, but also if they pass in the Indian Ocean towards the Cape of Good Hope in the southernmost point of Africa. Was this announcement made after the meeting was held with the Palestinian factions or before it? Because this might, if it happened after it, it might indicate that this was part of something to support the Palestinian resistance in its upcoming negotiations. What do you can say about that?
Our operations since day one have been in support of the Palestinian people and to prevent Zionist ships from passing through the Bab al-Mandeb Strait and reaching the port of Umm al-Rashrash, also known as the port of Eilat. With the continued massacres and genocide against our people in Palestine and the imposition of the siege on them, all ships heading to the ports of occupied Palestine were prevented from reaching, even those with different nationalities, thus tightening the noose on the occupation. When the Americans and the British intervened and announced their alliance called Prosperity Guardian and attacked the Yemeni Navy, resulting in 10 martyrs, their ships were subsequently included in the target list. With the tightening of the blockade in Gaza and talks of famine and deaths among the elderly and children, where more than 15 children died from famine, malnutrition and drought, it became imperative for us to further tighten the noose on the occupation.
هذه العمليات كلها مرتبطة بفلسطين حصرا ومرتبطة بإسناد أهلنا في فلسطين. موضوع العدوان علينا والرد على الأمريكيين نحن نستهدف السفنة وبوارجها الحربية وسفن.
Thus the announcement was made to expand Yemeni operations from the Red Sea to the Bab al-Mandeb Strait, to the Gulf of Aden, to the Arabian Sea, and now towards the Indian Ocean. These operations are exclusively linked to Palestine and supporting our people in Palestine. Regarding the aggression against Yemen and our response to the American British, we target their warships and merchant vessels. However, the expansion to the Indian Ocean is related to the Zionist siege on Gaza. As mentioned by Mr. Commander Abdel Malik al-Houthi, since the beginning of the war on Gaza, a group of missiles and drones has been launched from Sana'a, more than what was launched in 8 years on Saudi Arabia during the aggression on Yemen, and the coming is greater. The more severe the blockade and aggression against our people in Gaza, the greater our response will be.
This is what I want to discuss, Mr. Ali, because what do you think are the prospects of increasing this kind of economic pressure on the Zionist Israeli entity and the Americans and the UK by default? Will it escalate tensions in the region? I mean, could it potentially expand the scope of the conflict if the aggression on Gaza did not stop, if the negotiations did not work?
Whenever the blockade and aggression on Gaza intensify, it becomes imperative for the resistance in Gaza to escalate its strikes, and it becomes necessary for supporting fronts in various arenas to expand their operations. What we witnessed recently in terms of expansion in the north along the Lebanese border, there was an intensification of strikes by the Islamic resistance in Hezbollah, as well as in Yemen and Iraq. Thus, the expansion of the conflict is contingent on Zionist performance. The tighter the siege on our people in Gaza and the more frequent their strikes, the more there will be intensification of Palestinian strikes and strikes by supporting movements, because we must confront escalation with escalation. The ball is now in the court of the American and Zionist aggressors. If they do not want to escalate the conflict further, they must cease their aggression and lift the siege on Gaza. If they persist in aggression, the region will inevitably witness further escalation. All our options are open, as Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah said, between us lies the battlefield, the days and the nights. If the Israeli entity opts for escalation, they will not be received with flowers, smiles, statements or condemnations, but rather with more strikes, more iron and fire. Supporting operations are effective, and it is up to the Zionists and their settlers to endure these strikes, this siege and this situation that is heading towards a greater escalation.
هذا الحصار وهذه الضربات وهذا الوضع الذي هو يعني متجه إلى نحو التصعيد أكثر.
Mr. Ali Al-Zahri, Yemeni journalist and political commentator, it's a pleasure to have you on with us to discuss the meeting that happened between the Palestinian resistance factions and the Ansarullah Yemeni resistance faction. And from my platform, again, I want to thank my brothers and sisters in Yemen for their support for our brothers and sisters in Palestine. We are definitely one nation, one people, and this past war, genocidal war on Gaza, has proven that we are so. Ladies and gents, thank you very much. Assalamu alaikum.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight. In the United States, the Wisconsin Republican Mike Gallagher has said a forced TikTok sale could absolutely happen before next November. We take a look at the US media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The national broadcaster CBS News has covered this story and tells us more. The Wisconsin Republican Mike Gallagher has said it will be best if TikTok were out of China's hands before the next November's election. Representative Mike Gallagher, a Wisconsin Republican, said on Sunday, 17th of March, that the forced sale of TikTok absolutely could happen before November's election, as legislation that would demand the sale or ban the app altogether makes its way through Congress. The closer we get to an election, the risk just gets greater and greater, Gallagher said on Face the Nation program on Sunday, 17th of March. He talked of the threat posed by the widely popular video sharing app TikTok. TikTok has for years been under fire by US officials amid warnings that China's government could gain access to its data and use it to manipulate or spy on Americans. But a renewed push against the app gained momentum last week as the House approved legislation that would compel the company to either sell the app within 6 months or be banned from US app stores. Wisconsin Republican Mike Gallagher, who spearheaded the bill, noted that it will be in the financial interest of ByteDance's investors to effectuate before sale, saying that the user experience of the app would likely improve with a decreased concern of propaganda should the company move away from China-based ownership, causing TikTok to increase in value. On the risk that TikTok could pose to Americans, Representative Raja Krishnamurthy, an Illinois Democrat, said, "This is a different type of threat that we've seen before." He noted that TikTok differs from other social media platforms because it's effectively controlled by a foreign adversarial nation. And lawmakers in the House widely seem to agree, as the legislation saw significant bipartisan support just last week. But whether the Senate agrees remains to be seen. Representative Raja Krishnamurthy noted that he'd had very positive conversations with senators who he says are very interested in this bill and who are very surprised by the size of the margin of the overwhelming bipartisan support in the House. But how quickly Senate leadership decides to act on the bill is an open question. Kara Swisher, a business and technology journalist who appeared separately on Sunday on Face the Nation program, noted that there's a lot of people who would buy TikTok, like the owners of Microsoft, Meta, Apple, or a consortium of companies. But she said the question will revolve around what exactly they're buying, noting that the algorithm behind the app will likely remain in China's control. "What do you buy precisely because the algorithm's not coming with this company? The Chinese government would never let that happen," Swisher said. "You're buying 170 million, say, US users and a great brand, but the algorithm isn't there." The website Politico has also covered this story and tells us more. The Wisconsin Republican Mike Gallagher thinks a forced TikTok sale absolutely could and should happen before the 2024 election. The closer we get to an election, the risk just gets greater and greater, the Wisconsin Republican said on Sunday. Gallagher's comments come as the fate of TikTok hangs in the Senate. On Wednesday, the House passed the bill 352-65 that would force the Chinese parent company of TikTok, ByteDance, to divest TikTok within 165 days or risk the app being banned in the United States. The Senate is now expected to take up the bill, but its passage there is expected to be much more shaky. President Joe Biden has said he will sign the bill if it gets to his desk. Mike Gallagher cited a threat assessment by the Office of the Director of National Intelligence, which states that China may attempt to influence the 2024 elections in the United States, and that some accounts on TikTok, which were operated by the Chinese government, are reportedly targeted specific candidates on both sides of the aisle during the 2022 midterm election cycle. Every single intelligence community official that testified before the Intelligence Committee last week suggested that under its current ownership structure, TikTok is a threat to America's national security, according to Mike Gallagher. Essentially, the Chinese company ByteDance is the 100% owner of TikTok. ByteDance basically has an editor-in-chief who is embedded at the highest echelons of the company and controls all of its products. Mike Gallagher was asked about another factor that could complicate the bill's passage in the US Senate, a last-minute change of opinion from presumptive Republican presidential nominee Donald Trump, who said last Monday that while he believes TikTok poses a national security threat, he opposes banning the app in the United States because he believes it would benefit Facebook, his current Silicon Valley bête noire. Mike Gallagher didn't criticize Donald Trump directly, but took aim at the lobbying campaign, which has heavily featured former Trump advisor Kellyanne Conway. They're really weaponizing the swamp against legislative action, Gallagher said. Over $500,000 spent last quarter alone on 7 different lobbying firms. And it's disgusting.
If you ask me, why do I stand here so unafraid of everything around me? Proudly I would say, I am a Muslim. If you ask her, why does she dress that way, all covered up in a world that gives it all away? Proudly she would say, I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray 5 times a day when so many others have strayed, smiling he would say, I am a Muslim.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of God, welcome to another edition of the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javid, our guest speaker. Salam Sheikh, and welcome to the program.
Alaikum Assalam. Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. And we are going to talk about some of the jurisprudential laws related to the month of Ramadan and fasting. Sheikh Javid, let me start this episode with this question. Somebody asked, I wear medical glasses, and at the present, my eyes are too weak. The doctors told me if I do not strengthen my physique, my eyesight will get weaker and weaker. So if I'm unable to perform the Ramadan fast, what would be my duty?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Well, if fasting is harmful for his eyes, then it is not obligatory to fast.
Mm-hmm.
The truth of the matter is that it is obligatory for an ailing person who feels, who has genuine fear that fasting might hurt him in one way or the other. It could hurt his eyes or maybe other organs, important organs of his body. Then it is not even permissible for him to fast, because fasting is not supposed to harm someone. It's not supposed to hurt you. So if, for example, if your illness continues until next Ramadan, then it is not even necessary for you to give the qadha. There's no qadha either.
Mm-hmm.
So it is necessary that you give only one mud of foodstuff. One mud is equal to 750 grams of foodstuff, which you should give to the needy if you can afford it.
Mm-hmm.
That is the point.
Okay, thank you very much for this answer. There is another question that somebody asked. My mother is seriously sick, and my father is also physically weak. Nevertheless, both of them fast. Sometimes it's quite evident that fasting aggravates their illness. So far, I've not been able to persuade them to refrain from fasting, at least times when their illness is serious. Would you please guide us concerning the rule that applies to their fasting? Some people have the same problem. I had the same problem with my parents. Sometimes they're too old and too weak, and
they still persist on
fasting, although they know that it's somehow harmful for their health.
Yeah, I'm very much sure that there are some elderly people, grandparents, for example, who should not fast.
Yes.
Because they are too weak, emaciated, and actually old enough, which actually makes it unnecessary for them to fast.
Mm.
So the criterion actually in determining the inability of inability to fast, or whether fasting aggravates someone's health or not, is the opinion of the fasting person himself.
Right.
Maybe just as we talked some in the previous episode, maybe a doctor tells you something, but you have your own opinion, your own judgment of your ability. So if you think you can fast, there's no problem. You should fast. But okay, sometimes you think it's not harming your health. It's not injurious to your health. It does not aggravate your health. Then if there is someone who gives you a better advice, you should listen to him. Because, for example, if someone is 85 years old, 90, and he is very old, he must have his drink and water and food on time, then he should not fast, because fasting might harm.
Deteriorate the situation. Yes. Yeah, thank you very much. Let's take a short break, and then we'll be back to continue our program, Islamic Laws, on RIB English Radio. Stay tuned.
Ya Allah, thank you for another chance standing at my door. Ya Allah, you've given me hope, delivered this gift right to my home. Marhab, marhab, ya Ramadan, ahyi qulubana bil Qur'an.
Uh, Back to the program, Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio with me, Mohammed Jawad Hussain Swagra, and Sheikh Chavid, our guest speaker. We are still talking about some of the jurisprudential laws related to fasting and the blessed month of Ramadan with Sheikh Chavid. Somebody asked, Sheikh Chavid, last year I had a surgery on my kidneys and the surgeon ordered me not to fast for the rest of my life. However, I eat and drink normally and don't feel any signs of illness. What is my duty?
Well, if you personally do not fear, and I'm talking to that person because he says, I had surgery on my kidneys last year, so I'm talking to him. I should say that if you personally do not fear any harm in fasting, and there is no reasonable ground to be afraid that fasting might negatively affect on your health, on maybe on your kidney, and it will not aggravate your health condition, then it is obligatory to fast, because you yourself better know. But you know better than everyone else that fasting does not harm you. Even if the doctor has told you not to fast until the end of your life, but okay, you know, fasting is not, you know, you can make it, you can do it.
Sheikh Chavid, that doctors actually give their prescription based on each and every case.
Yeah.
When they see their patients, and generally they give orders like and prescription, for example, what to follow and what not to follow, or what to eat and what not to eat, or what pills to take and what not to take. Yeah. But the thing is, the symptoms do not immediately show up.
Sure, you're right.
Right? And these people might see nothing. No, they have no fear because they don't see any signs or symptoms for their diseases. But later they might run into some problems.
If they do not fast because of the fact that, okay, the doctors advised them, they are not to blame, okay? Mm. Because they are justified in not fasting. They listen to someone who is an expert in healthcare.
Yes.
Okay. So if they do not fast and later they find, okay, it was good for him not to fast, so that's good, okay? But if they happen to fast, contrary to what the doctors told him, the fasting is considered to be valid in this situation.
And also some doctors, Sheikh, especially I'm talking about the Western Hemisphere, like in the West, because mostly the doctors and physicians are not aware of the Islamic laws. They are not Muslims, right? They are in a non-Muslim populated area. And when you, as a Muslim patient, refer to those doctors and hospitals, and they may, tell you, for example, to eat every, I don't know, few hours or drink every few hours, right?
Yes.
And, obviously they don't know anything about, for example, Ramadan and the rules of Ramadan, which is fasting, basically.
Yes.
And should these Muslim patients obey those non-Muslim doctors or physicians?
Well, as you know, doctors give their advice regardless of your religious beliefs.
Yes.
And or your background in history, maybe, and your religious teachings. So, in fact, if a physician's statement makes a patient confident that fasting is harmful for him, or he has genuine fear of harm as a result of fasting because of some certain, reasonable grounds that he sees, so then it's actually not obligatory for him to fast.
Okay.
Rather, in some cases when it is generally feared that fasting might have a negative effect on his health, it is even not permissible to fast.
Okay, thank you very much. Let's, come back after a short break and continue our program, Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio. Stay with us.
The followers of Ayatollah Khomeini can refer to leader.ir/en. In the section Religious Affairs, you can ask your question and receive the answer. In the library section, some of Ayatollah Khamenei's works of jurisprudence are available, including practical laws of Islam, frequently asked questions, comparative fatwa, and newly asked questions.
Allah, ya Allah, guide me all the way to your Jannah, ya Allah, oh Allah. Don't let me go astray, cause I need you.
Back to the program, Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Jad, hosting this program. I'm Sheikh Javid, our guest speaker. We're still talking about some of the jurisprudential laws related to the month of God, Ramadan, and fasting. Sheikh Javid, somebody asked, I have kidney stones, and the only way to prevent them from calcifying is to continuously consume water and fluids. As doctors have prohibited me from fasting, what's my duty regarding fasting during the blessed month of Ramadan?
Well, doctors do give their expert opinions regarding things they witnessed through their own experience and observations. Of course, when you have developed a kidney stone, it is necessary to act according to your doctor's advice. And in some cases, it's necessary, of course, as you rightly mentioned, it's necessary to drink water every now and then in order to make the stone come out. So, of course, if the treatment or the illness requires that you drink water and or maybe other beverages as prescribed by the doctor, it is obligatory to act according to your doctor's advice and not to follow what you would like to do. Maybe some believers do like to fast, and fasting provides them with a very pleasant experience. So it's better, it's sometimes obligatory that they actually follow the doctor's advice and not to hurt themselves.
I see. Even some people are not basically sick or ill, and they are not considered as patients, and they don't refer to the doctors, but yet they, fear some kind of medical condition for them. Like, for example, if they don't drink, they're going to have trouble. What about those individuals? You know, since they don't refer to the doctors and there are no doctors to tell them, for example, whether to do this or not, then what is their duty?
Well, it's not always necessary to turn to a doctor and get his advice on one's health. One's personal judgment about his own health is important. So if one knows and has the genuine fear that it is fasting might be harmful to his health and may cause him some damage in some way or another, then actually it's not obligatory on him to observe fast.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much, Sheikh Javid. And thank you, my dear listeners, for listening to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Jawad, as the host of this program. And from the rest of the crew, we say wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Oh Allah, please unite us and guide us to paradise. Oh, and guide us to paradise. Ramadan is here. Allah's mercy is near. Time to give, time to share, time to show. Ramadan is here. Ramadan.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave, 31 meters, 9,650 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent. And FM, 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAD 5 and IntelSat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is pasttoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.